Hello, and welcome to the podcast for the journal Integrated Environmental Assessment and Management, better known as IEAM. I'm Jenny Shaw. In this special episode of the IEAM podcast, we speak with authors from the special series, Consequences of Modern Warfare on Ecology and the Environment. The series presents a collection of views from global experts on the broad environmental consequences raised by ecocide as a result of war. We hear from experts on a range of topics, including legacy chemicals in Ukraine, the concept of warfare ecology, using remote sensing to track environmental damage when it's too dangerous to be on the ground, and applying a natural resource damage assessment in Ukraine. All of our authors acknowledge the importance and priority of addressing the human suffering that occurs during armed conflict. But these experts also take a longer, broader view beyond the acute suffering to ask what is needed to sustain the survivors during and especially after the conflict. What will these people need as they rebuild their lives and communities? Getting answers to these questions is the focus of the special series and today's podcast. We start off with a chemical that has become ubiquitous in the media, PFAS, the shorthand way to refer to per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. People usually associate PFAS with the lining of nonstick pans, takeout food packaging, or stain-resistant fabric. However, because of their high thermal tolerance, PFAS are also used in military munitions and are released into the air and ground upon detonation. PFAS are known as forever chemicals because they persist in the environment and wildlife, and they can be harmful to wildlife and humans that are exposed. To learn more, we spoke with Lauren Coben, lead author of an article on PFAS exposure through munitions in the Russia-Ukraine war. Lauren is an Academy Professor of Environmental Science at the United States Military Academy. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Jenny. Thank you so much for having me.
So, what made you focus on PFAS in Ukraine?
I wanted to study PFAS because of my personal experience being in the military and having soldiers that were trained using the firefighting foam, which has been found to contain so many of the different PFAS compounds. And realizing my soldiers were exposed while they were using it, but also after leaving areas, the fact that those chemicals were left behind in the environment. PFAS are also used in munitions to help keep them thermally resistant and stable. And understanding that PFAS were in munitions and getting into the air, I really thought that it would be applicable to understand what was going on in the Ukraine, in addition to what everyone else already expects with a modern warfare. But sometimes we fail to think about the environment or secondary and tertiary human health exposure. It's the long-term exposure well after conflict that may cause more harm than what we immediately expect during an actual conflict.
How do you see your work being applied to prevention or even restoration in future conflicts?
Our research falls into getting a better understanding of the baseline, fate transport, and chemicals within the environment. Unfortunately, the best prevention would probably be no more conflict, but we know that's not going to happen. So our research is going to help people become more aware of some of those secondary and tertiary effects, as I previously mentioned, in regard to human exposure and environmental impact.
Lauren then mentioned something that really caught my attention, underscoring how a regional conflict can lead to unintended global repercussions.
An interesting point that I wasn't aware of was just how much of the agriculture within Ukraine is exported. And you think about PFAS, because they are so pervasive, they can be in waters used for irrigation, they can be in crops, then these crops are then transported to different locations in the country or even exported globally. And so what you think of a Russian-Ukraine conflict issue is absolutely a much larger global issue.
That was Lauren Coben discussing her article on PFAS exposure through munitions in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Next, we delve into the concept of warfare ecology. Jacob Berkowitz discusses taking a warfare ecology perspective to understanding and managing risks to wetlands, habitats that are often deliberately altered during armed conflict, and how we can use that knowledge to improve restoration and conservation efforts. Jacob is a research soil scientist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Hi, Jacob. Thanks so much for chatting with us today.
Hey, Jenny. Thanks for the opportunity to promote our paper and tell you a little bit about some of the research that we've been up to.
Can you start us off by explaining the concept of warfare ecology?
Warfare ecology is the way that warfare induces changes on the ecosystem. It's not just people dropping bombs out in the forest somewhere and causing damage. It's part of a larger cycle. People think of warfare as something that happens and then it ends, but the warfare ecology concept really highlights the fact that warfare is a continuous cycle that moves from preparation to active war to recovery and then repeats itself over time. There's the pre-war or preparation phase where we're doing things like training, we're developing installations, we're preparing for potential conflict. Then you move into the active conflict phase, like we see now with the situation in Ukraine. And then there's a third separate phase, which is the post-conflict restoration phase, where we are dealing with the direct effects of warfare, cleaning up potential hazardous chemicals that have been released, but also secondary effects, because we have a lot of displaced populations, and they change the way that natural resources can be interacted with and at times overused as the result of those conflicts.
How did you come to focus on wetlands for this work?
So our team's been working for quite some time on a project which is designed to help the Department of Defense become more resilient in the face of extreme weather and other challenges. And as part of that effort, we know that wetlands are something that can really build resiliency into ecosystems, and that benefits the communities that live near those ecosystems. So we wanted to really focus on wetlands because they are one of the most productive ecosystems on the planet, but they also provide more benefits than other habitat types, both for natural systems and for society.
How do you see your research being applied to mitigate potential damage to wetlands?
If you look, for example, at military installations and how they're used for training purposes, a lot of those military installations are the big green spots left on the map in a lot of our developed areas. Military activities can also cause wetland degradation. And so we work really hard to manage those areas for the benefit of a number of species. We have very active conservation programs on our installations, and those installations serve as refugia, really, for a number of threatened and endangered species. If we look at something like the post-war rebuilding phase, there's a lot of opportunities to improve management of how we interact with the environment to the benefit of wetland creatures and the habitats that they provide. And so we can do things like restore coastal wetlands to not only provide habitat, but also reduce the risk of flooding and decrease the effects of storm surge as we're seeing ever increasing intensity of hurricanes and other storms.
Do you see other locations that are in need of wetland restoration or in the process of restoration who can take these military sites like case studies? And are people more receptive to incorporating these kinds of approaches?
There are valuable case studies that have occurred on our military installations. For example, we have the opportunity to manage large areas with prescribed fire. And it's kind of counterintuitive that we would use fire in wetland ecosystems, but we do have a number of pyrophytic wetland species that actually require periodic fire as part of their life cycle. And then others, including groups like the Nature Conservancy, have worked with us on a number of our properties and expanded that type of management beyond the installation boundaries.
That was Jacob Berkowitz talking about the benefits of taking a warfare ecology perspective to managing wetland ecosystems affected by military activity. Now we'll pivot from using fire as a management tool to situations where fire is used as a deliberate military strategy in armed conflict. The region of Nagorno-Karabakh lies within the borders of Azerbaijan, but control of the region has been violently contested between Armenia and Azerbaijan for decades, most recently in September 2023. One article in this series examines the environmental damage resulting from the particularly violent conflict in 2020, with hundreds of fires set in just 44 days. We spoke with lead author Owen Derbyshire about how he uses remote sensing technology to assess environmental damage in Nagorno-Karabakh. Owen is a researcher at the Conflict and Environment Observatory in the UK. Hi, Owen. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Jenny. Thank you for the invite and for putting together the special issue.
Your paper describes a specific conflict and one that our listeners may not be totally familiar with. Can you tell us a bit about the conflict?
Nagorno-Karabakh, it's a small disputed territory between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And the war happened in autumn 2020. It was really short, just 44 days, but the fighting was very intense. From our remote vantage point here in the UK, we were able to track different environmental dimensions using Earth observations and by geolocating social media footage. So there was a significant use of fire as a military tool. Some of those fires, they were deliberate, part of an intentional military strategy to make smoke screens, to make operations easier, particularly given drones were heavily involved in this war. And this relationship between conflict and fire is very common. We see it elsewhere in lots of other circumstances. At the moment, very strongly in Ukraine.
Do you have a sense how any of the types of damage you mentioned are being managed?
So the territory that was gained by Azerbaijan in that area, they've gone on this really radical, rapid land cover changes. So they're building lots of roads straight through high integrity forestry, new airports, roads. They're potentially expanding mining activities and so on and so forth. And all of this has been done without any environmental oversight. As far as we can see, no proper impact assessments or due process. So actually what we're seeing is things getting worse, not better.
For people outside the region that are watching this unfold, is it simply something that you have to stand by and watch? Or are there organizations in either country that are observing this as well and attempting to do something about it?
The situation in Azerbaijan for civil society groups or academics to kind of monitor this is, it's difficult to do anything which might put you in a position where you're coming to conflict with the government. What there actually is around this conflict is an incredible level of partisan behaviour. There's very little in between. In that kind of situation, it's hard to build bridges and do things together to monitor things. So we're kind of left for trying to do things remotely. And things are changing quickly with Earth observation technologies and also access to higher resolution imagery. We can do quite a lot now, more than we could have 2 or 3 years ago even.
That was Owen Derbyshire discussing how he uses remote sensing techniques to analyze fire-related environmental damage following armed conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. Our next segment takes us to Colombia, where large-scale land use changes are still occurring years after the most intense fighting ended. In the year 2016, after more than 50 years of violent conflict, the Colombian government signed a peace agreement with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the rebel group known internationally as FARC. However, our next guest found that deforestation actually increased after the peace agreement. To learn more, we spoke with author Paulo Murillo Sandoval, who used remote sensing to uncover illicit land use changes in areas controlled by rebels. Hi, Paulo. Thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Hello, Jenny. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Will you start us off by giving us some brief background on the situation now in Colombia?
Colombia is one of those places in which our conflict has been situated for many, many years. And the impacts of our conflict has been dramatical. One of the victims in this case, based on the transition between our conflict to stable peace, has been the forest, because the amount of forest loss that we are capturing using satellite data is giant. And since 2016, when the Colombian government, FARC, this rebel group that was fighting against the government, they finally signed this peace agreement. There is a bunch of deforestation since 2016 onwards.
Can you tell us a bit more about your finding regarding armed conflict and the environmental changes?
We tried to identify at the beginning just deforestation, just highlight that more than 50% of the area has been changed because of these transitions from conflict to post-peace agreement situation. Then we wanted to know if that deforestation is now agricultural areas or what is the land cover type. The other aspect that is important is there are some illicit land activities. We are talking about coca farming, and we are also talking about illicit cattle ranching lands. Something important to mention here is that this rebel group has been in control of the territory for a long time. They have specific rules. They tell people how to use forests and where and when they can use forest resources or not. And now we are able to identify the locations in which there are coca farming or tiny plots that are using for producing cocaine and new giant patches of forest loss that are linked to cattle ranching lands.
In the paper, you also looked at the broader consequences of these land use changes. Can you talk a bit about that?
The problem with all these particular changes is that we are disconnecting the environmental connection between the Andes region and the Amazon watershed. And there is a constant fluid of species, flora, endemism that is moving from the Andes in Colombia to the south of Brazil. The location in which deforestation is located is very important because it can disconnect places that are very important for the movement of species or endemism or people that survive in these locations. We can have a bunch of deforestation in one location, but still connectivity is okay. In other places, if you even have a small deforestation rates of changes, you might have a bunch of disconnection between patches. It's very important to not only highlight the role of deforestation, but what is actually happening with connectivity.
That was Paulo Murillo Sandoval talking about the increase in deforestation and illicit land use in Colombia since the 2006 peace agreement. Life in Ukraine changed forever when Russia invaded in February 2022. The war continues as of press time, some 20 months later. The humanitarian toll is too significant to cover here in detail, with casualties estimated to be in the tens to hundreds of thousands, more than 10 million refugees, and thousands of reported war crimes. One type of war crime that is increasingly recognized by the global community is ecocide, the deliberate destruction of the environment with the intent of causing long-term damage. In fact, Ukraine is building a case against Russia for ecocide. Beyond the usual environmental tolls of war, like deforestation, fires, landmines, and habitat destruction, Ukraine's agricultural infrastructure suffered heavy losses with significant ramifications for the global grain industry. Ukraine also accuses Russian forces of destroying the country's largest dam, which caused catastrophic flooding of polluted water that affected hundreds of thousands of people. However, building the case for ecocide and holding Russia accountable is a complicated matter. One article in this series proposes applying a U.S. natural resource damage assessment to the situation in Ukraine. We spoke with the authors to hear more. First, we'll hear from lead author Rick Wenning, who is a principal at Montrose Environmental Solutions in the U.S., and he's also the founding and former editor-in-chief of IEAM. Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Jenny.
When we're talking about armed conflict, the environmental consequences aren't usually what come to people's minds first. What drew your interest to the topic?
Armed conflict is not so much unlike environmental devastation that's associated with a natural disaster or an industrial accident. Most often we attach the human suffering to war, and rightly so. But the environment suffers and has a very long-lasting effect on the natural environment. The recovery after war can linger for years and years and years. And again, that's not that unlike what we experience in natural disasters or industrial accidents. So the skills and the expertise that I've developed and so many others in the CTAC community and elsewhere are applicable as we think about the environmental damages associated with war, just as we've thought about the environmental damages associated with an industrial accident or a natural disaster. Those skills, that knowledge, many of the methods for assessing damages, quantifying the injuries to wildlife, to soils, to air, to water, are transferable in the context of evaluating the damages caused by war, and transferable in the context as well of how we recover that environment. And that's what inspired me on this paper. There are not that many well-developed methodologies like the US NRDA framework available in other places in the world that could be applied to help, for instance, in this case, Ukraine, understand the nature and extent of the war-related damages and plan for its recovery.
In the paper, you mention ecocide and the renewed interest in calling for ecocide to be officially recognized as a war crime. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Ecocide is not officially recognized as a war crime, but the notion that an aggressor in a time of war or conflict could purposely target the environment with the intent to harm in order to achieve its ends, as opposed to just say, for instance, focusing on military targets, is something that I think the international courts are taking very, very seriously. But it's a very delicate matter, you can imagine. And it's a very complex issue with regard to making that kind of proof that the environment has been targeted, as opposed to collateral damage in the course of a war.
We then spoke with RICS co-author Ted Tomasi, an expert in NRDA. Ted is a managing principal at Integral Consulting in the U.S. Here's Ted discussing the logistics of applying the NRDA framework in Ukraine.
As I thought about what was going on in Ukraine, it struck me that this really did fit the natural resource damage assessment situation, where you have some events or set of events that cause a harm to natural resources and the services that they provide. And the real issue is, how do we compensate for that? How do we make the public whole from, you know, what they've suffered from that event? It just seemed to fit the overall structure of what Ukraine is facing. But, you know, there's certainly some challenges. And the challenges, I think, come from a couple of places. One, you know, you measure impacts from a baseline. What would have occurred but for the war? And we know that there were already environmental challenges in Ukraine. We know that there was ongoing conflict in the eastern regions. And so the already impacts of the kinds that were then magnified by the invasion. So sorting out what is new from what would have been at baseline is a major challenge. And I think the second one is just its scale. If you have something in which natural resource damage assessment methods are applied, they're usually fairly localized, but Ukraine is another order of magnitude with implications nationally across sectors between natural resources and all the roads and buildings and hospitals and schools and other things that have housing that have been damaged, the energy infrastructure. So the situation is more complex and we'll need to adapt the principles of NRDA, but we're going to have to adapt the methods in order to apply to such a complex situation.
That was Rick Wenning and Ted Tomasi discussing their work on applying a U.S. NRDA framework to the situation in Ukraine. You've been listening to the authors of the IEAM special series, Consequences of Modern Warfare on Ecology and the Environment. Access the entire series in the March 2003 issue of IEAM. Just go to ctechjournals.org. I'm Jenny Shaw, and thank you for listening to the IEAM podcast.